James Howard Kunstler writes in a very blunt, in-your-face fashion, telling you what's about to happen, what is happening with regard to energy and our economy. And it seems to me, James, that in every even biggest of disasters, there are winners and losers. So there are going to be areas that will do and people that will do better than others during this long emergency. Can you pick out any of the winners or good places to be?
Well, this is a kind of fascinating aspect in reflecting on where we're going and what's going to happen with us. And, you know, of course, I don't pretend to have a crystal ball, but I think that there are some predictions that you can make. They're already pretty clear. This period I call the long emergency will be one of economic hardship, political turbulence, and some parts of the United States are going to do better than others. I'm rather pessimistic about the Southwest.
Yes, Phoenix, I read that.
Phoenix, Las Vegas, which you apparently live near.
Yeah, that's right.
The excitement will be over in Las Vegas. Tucson. These places are going to have really severe problems on top of the energy problems they face.
Because of?
Well, first of all, you're going to have severe problems with water. You're already bumping up against those problems, especially in the Las Vegas area.
That's quite right.
They're only going to be exacerbated by the problems that you have with petroleum and natural gas. It's hard to, you know, people think about, cheap air conditioning in Phoenix. Phoenix is virtually unlivable without some kind of air conditioning relief. You get 100 days
That's right.
A year with three-digit temperatures.
Correct.
And it's really hard to take, and air conditioning has made it possible. Not just air conditioning, but cheap air conditioning that most people can afford at some level.
You're absolutely right.
And, so on top of that, and water problems, and friction with Mexico, which I think is going to continue and become worse, because as the American economy suffers and stumbles, the Mexican economy will suffer by another order of magnitude, and that will tend to increase the volume of people seeking to leave Mexico and come north, even if America is struggling. And I think that friction is going to increase and become a much more severe problem.
All right. Let me interject one possibility here.
Yeah.
We are, after all, working on a number of other energy sources. Now, there's no magic bullet yet, but wind energy and solar energy and some of these hydrothermal, some of these other things we're working on, biodiesel, there's no single solution, but it looks like there may be an array of possible alternative solutions out there that could, at the very least, slow what you're talking about.
Well, this is the hope of many people. And indeed, there's plenty of reason to believe that we will be using virtually all of these things in the years to come. But I would direct you to a basic formula, which is that no amount of alternative fuels or renewables or systems for using them is going to allow us to run the United States the way we're used to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it.
All right, then let's talk a little.
And so it leads to a consideration of what actually might happen. And I think what you'll see is that some of these systems of solar, wind power, hydropower, there are more esoteric ones even, I think that some of them will be used on a very local basis, perhaps even on a household basis. But we're not going to just plug and play the equipment that we're now using. You know, we're not going to run the interstate highway system on biodiesel. I've been having a correspondence with biodiesel enthusiasts by email for the last 10 days.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm rather amazed at the things that they don't think about.
Like what?
Well, for example, if you reflect on the idea that industrial agriculture in America, based on fossil fuel inputs, is going to be in trouble. and that we're going to have to change the way we do farming and food production.
Right.
One of the basic conclusions you come to is that we are probably going to need more acreage to make up for the crop losses that we will have as a result of not being able to pour fertilizers and pesticides on the soil. We'll have to. It'll take more acres to grow an equivalent amount of food.
Okay, but that aspect of the long emergency is still quite a ways down the road. I'm talking about the time that we become short of fertilizers.
Well, wait a minute. I'm talking about biodiesel fuels as one of the alternatives that people are proposing. And
right.
A lot of people think we're just going to take, you know, X amount of acreage and devote it to growing soybeans or hemp or algae or something that will produce oil, and that will run the interstate highway system on these crops.
Well, not in totality, certainly, but it can help, right?
I wonder if we're going to be able to do it at all. This is the point I'm making, is that I think we're vastly underestimating the amount of cropland we're going to have to dedicate not only to growing food for human beings, but in addition, growing feed for working animals, which
right.
requires tremendous amount of dedicated cropland and acreage. And, you know, the biodiesel people have this kind of weird suburban view of things. It's a kind of a gee whiz. You know, here I am sitting in front of my computer having fun making algorithms and looking at the screen, but I'm not really thinking of the real world out there. And the real world is we're going to need a lot more acreage for growing food for humans and for animals. And I'm not convinced at all that there's going to be much land that we can devote to growing biomass for these biofuels.
Okay.
I think it's a chimerical kind of a pursuit, a quixotic pursuit.
Let's talk very quickly about our leadership. What you describe must be obvious to more than just you. I mean, it's virtually a national security issue. All the way around, no matter how you crack it up. It's a national security issue. So what is our leadership doing? I mean, most Americans would expect, as we look at something of this magnitude, we have something along the lines of a Manhattan Project to come up with something to stop what otherwise is ahead for us.
We are completely unserious, Art. We are lost in raptures of infotainment from top to bottom. Let me give you an example of something that we could do that we're just not doing anything about. If we could restore the passenger railroad system in the United States, we could take a very significant amount of pressure off of our oil imports, because so much of our oil is dedicated to running cars. If we could restore the passenger rail system, we could take a lot of the pressure off of the airports that are now suffering from tremendous congestion and flight delays, because they're running all these flights between cities that are 400 miles apart that would be much better served by rail. We would give people a choice. It would just do wonderful things for us.
James, would people make that choice?
Let me continue for a minute, because there are additional things there are additional implications to this. One
sure.
is, this is a project that is doable. We know how to run railroads. We know how to build them. We know how to fix them. All the technology is proven and established.
True.
So if we could restore the national railroad system, that would do a lot for the morale of the American public and give them a sense that they had some power to help themselves and affect their own lives in the face of these energy problems that are coming down at us. But this is the one thing that nobody wants to do, you know?
Well, let's look at it for a second. If we had an in-place efficient rail system, would people use it?
Of course they would. Of course they would. Certainly, if it was run at the level above the kind of Bulgarian National Railroad Service that we run it at now, people will not take trains that arrive 3 hours late. You know, people will not take trains that do not show up on time, but they will take trains that leave on time, that follow timetables, that are reliable. And we just haven't had that in this country for years. And it would give people at least a significant new choice, and we wouldn't have to be running our cars all the time for everything that we do. Especially for the, you know, it's one thing to talk about, you know, making those 7 trips a day to the school, the Walmart, the soccer field, the pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing when you're talking about, you know, people who have to go from Columbus, Ohio to Cleveland. And there are plenty of them every day. All these people out there piloting their own vehicles, making these 325-mile trips, these tedious and often dangerous trips, you know, for people who are 70 years old behind the wheel, you know, that's not a good thing for everybody to be the pilot of their own vehicle. Anyway, you know, there are models for this in other parts of the world where it happens to work pretty well, and we just don't want to do this. You know, we're too intellectually and economically lazy to begin this process.
Well, one of those areas, to some degree at least, is a lot of Europe. A lot of Europe has pretty good rail systems and transportation within cities. Paris is great. Gee, you can bop around Paris very efficiently underground on the rails.
And you can get to a train station and hop on a train to Amsterdam and get to Amsterdam and take a tram into the heart of Amsterdam without ever having to get into a car and without suffering because of it. You know, people in Europe don't feel... you know, they don't feel like losers because they're getting on trains.
Hmm.
You know, but it's obviously a different social experience. You know, you have to, you have to feel that it's okay to be with other human beings acting in a civilized manner.
It's true.
We're just out of the habit. It's not that, you know, it's not that it's such a terrible thing. It's just that we're not used to it. The fact of the matter is we're not going to be able to continue living the way we're living anyway, so we're going to have to do this whether we do like it or not. I think the nut of the problem we're talking about is why haven't we started talking about it? Why didn't you, you know, I happen to not be a Bush voter. I happen to have been a registered Democrat, although not a happy one, okay? You know, John Kerry didn't say a word about restoring passenger railroad service.
No, he did not.
And it was one of the few things that he could have said that would have encouraged Americans to feel some confidence about our ability to do things and get things done.
So if you were in a position of power, you would renew the rail system. Anything else?
I would start with that because it's such an easily doable thing and it would do so much for our national morale.
Okay. What else would you do if you had the power? I mean, what should we be doing?
We should be doing everything possible to get rid of the incentives to continue to build more suburban sprawl, because everything that we put in the ground now is going to have a tragic outcome. Every housing development that is getting started now, every new strip mall that goes in is going to be just one more dysfunctional entity in, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 years, and is going to be a tremendous liability for American civilization.
Well, your picture is kind of a downer both ways. I mean, suburbia is going to deteriorate, and the cities are going to contract. So
yes,
there's going to be pain everywhere virtually.
Yeah, there is. It's going to be hard to nobody is going to get off easy in this tremendous period of hardship and contraction. But, you know, as we started saying earlier, some places will do better than other places. I happen to think that the Northeast and the upper Midwest will do somewhat better than the Sun Belt.
Why?
Well, I think what you'll see in the Sun Belt is that it will suffer in proportion exactly to the degree that it benefited from the last 30 years of the final cheap oil fiesta that we've been enjoying.
But the Northeast doesn't get off the hook. I mean,
it doesn't get off the hook.
We've got to run the air conditioners, but during those long, cold winters, you've got to have the oil.
Well, we're going to have problems with that for sure. But, you know, one of the other problems in the Sun Belt is that up until really just after World War II, the Eastern Sun Belt, or the Wet Sun Belt, you know, the states of the old Confederacy, were generally agricultural states. There were few cities of consequence. There were a lot of towns, but few great cities of consequence right after World War II. And most of what happened in the South after World War II was really the result of this cheap oil fiesta and the suburban building program that went with it. And so most of the construction in the South, most of the stuff that exists is new. And most of it is not going to work very well. It's going to be a much more of a liability for people in the Sun Belt and for the kind of economy they're going to have to transform themselves into. And I think that, you know, there are all sorts of hidden consequences that haven't really begun to show yet. And one of them is this, that, you know, as this suburban infrastructure for daily living becomes worthless and dysfunctional in the South, I think you're going to see a great deal of conflict arise out of it. And some of it may even become violent as this society attempts to kind of reallocate our resources and reallocate our land for different purposes.
How do you see conflict developing?
Well, for one thing, I think that you'll see in the NASCAR belt, as I call it, I think that there is an attitude of hyper-individualism that is pretty common. The notion that the, you know, individual rights are supremely important.
There is.
And this combines with a romance for firearms and violence, and the idea that firearms should be used liberally in defense of hyper-individualism.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of these things will combine to produce some very unfortunate politics in the South, a politics of grievance and resentment that is liable to boil over into violence, especially with the suburbs tanking and people losing their homes and all of their investments and their livelihoods. And I think we'll see...
new division between the North and South?
Well, I think we'll just see, for starters, a lot of conflict in the South between the people who are hanging on, and the people who are doing very poorly. A lot of this conflict may arise around the issue of the reallocation of land, because we're not going to be using it for suburbia anymore. We're probably going to have to return to local agriculture. You know, the hallmark of the period of the long emergency is that we're going to have to live profoundly and intensely local.
So we're going to have to rip up the concrete and plant crops.
Well, I don't know that we're going to be able to rip up a whole lot of asphalt. We're going to have to work around what we got. The subdivision practices of the last 50 years have been very destructive, ruinously destructive of the integrity of the landscape, so that, you know, in many places you've actually destroyed the ability of the land to be used in a coherent, integral way for farm production.
How can it be this serious, this close? I mean, you talked about 3 years.
Yeah.
This serious and this close, and our leaders not yet jumping all over it. Hold that answer, James. We're at the top of the hour. James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. If you don't believe what you're hearing, then you might want to read the book, because it's carefully annotated, and, you know, all these things are like numbers you can add up, and the conclusions appear inescapable. Maybe there's something I'm missing, some zero-point wondrous invention that'll save us, but I haven't seen it yet. Have you?